The Jason Rance Show.
Once again, a story you can't believe is real, but Jason Rance of Seattle confirms it is.
Seattle residents are outraged.
Jason, tell us the state of the Seattle Police Department, if you will.
Rance took pictures of trash and syringes on the ground around the camp.
Jason Rance is with us. This is your story. I want you to take us all the way through.
Thank you for being the person to go in there and show us what's happening.
When asked to tell us the strategy on COVID, Vice President Kamala Harris makes no sense whatsoever. We're going to talk with the newly appointed state senator, Simon Sefcik, just 22 years old. So what are his priorities as the youngest state senator serving? Plus, Ted Cruz just loses it at a progressive reporter whining about masks. You're going to laugh when you hear this audio. We're going to get to that and so much more this hour of the Jason Rance Show, brought to you by You Build It. But first, this.
The traffic.
Still in downtown Seattle, westbound on Mercer Street at Elliott Avenue is partially blocking the intersection. Still keeping an eye on this traffic in Bothell. Northbound 405 at 195th Street, the exit is partially blocked due to a crash. It's causing a slowdown further the Juanita area. And in Everett, a crash on eastbound Highway 2 at Homemakers Road is blocking the right lane, causing a heavy backup from I-5. That's the latest. I'm Tiamma Fulton, AM 770 KTTH Traffic.
The Monologue.
Okay, Vice President Harris did this interview with the Today Show. And she was asked about the strategy that is currently in place for COVID. What exactly are you doing? Are you going to change things? At what point, in fact, she was asked, would you change something about your response when things on the ground change? You should change with the change, meaning COVID starts to act in ways that you didn't really expect. We get a different variant that is very clearly less severe, is evading the vaccines. What would you do? Kamala Harris's response makes no sense whatsoever.
It is time for us to do what we have been doing, and that time is every day. Every day it is time for us to agree that there are things and tools that are available to us to slow this thing down.
Did that make any sense? I'm not kidding. Did that answer? And I didn't cut out anything. This will just one more time.
It is time for us to do what we have been doing in that time.
Okay, hold on. It is time for us to do what we have been doing. So the question is, at what point would you change your approach to COVID?
It is time for us to do what we have been doing, and that time is every day.
I don't know what that means. It's like the world's dumbest fortune cookie. Is she talking in riddle? Is this a riddle? Are we supposed, what's black and white and red all over? I know a newspaper. Some of them, because some of them are in color too. Did any of that make sense? No. It's almost like she was caught off guard by that question, which of course she shouldn't be. And true leaders who know what's going on, who have a grasp on things, who have a grasp on their own supposed strategy, would be able to answer that question. But instead, you got a lot of gibberish. You got gibberish that didn't mean anything. I mean, you got that from Joe Biden earlier today in his announcement that they are going to tackle the COVID situation in a different way than they were before. That I guess Kamala Harris didn't realize was happening. But this is how the president started today.
Now, I don't like to, outline the next steps we're taking against.
Don't like to.
I'd like to outline the next steps we're taking against the Omicron variant.
That's how he started off today. Do you, and answer this completely honestly, and I know that there's some liberals who listen to the show, you do listen, and I appreciate that, whether live or on the podcast. Given both of those answers on a very, very, for Kamala Harris, a basic question, and for Joe Biden, just reading off of a teleprompter, do you have a sense that they know what it is they're doing? Or maybe deep down inside, as much as you hate the Republicans, you are concerned with what it is they're doing. And I want you to really, truly, honestly answer that question.
The interview.
News that King County prosecutor Dan Satterberg is not running for re-election means lots of folks are stepping into the ring to replace him. One of those candidates is the mayor of Federal Way. His name is Jim Farrell, and he joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Obviously, you've been having some significant issues with Dan Satterberg's approach to crime in, you know, not just your city, but really this region. And we're not just talking about petty crime. We're talking about violent crime. Did you make the decision to run before or after his decision to call it quits?
Well, you know, that's a great question, Jason. Now, I filed the paperwork. I haven't formally announced yet, and I'm putting my team together and all of that. So a formal announcement will be coming very shortly. But the reason I'm, you know, really thinking about this, I had made the decision that I likely was going to run against him, and I was going to run this year for prosecutor, simply because you hit the nail on the head. I'm very concerned about safety in this region, not just in Federal Way, but all over South King County. I've literally called the mayors and city managers for, you know, all the cities in King County and talked with them about their concerns, and they're all concerned. And many residents of Federal Way are very concerned about lack of prosecutions for minor and serious crimes. So it's been something that's been brewing for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, I facilitated a group of South King County mayors and police chiefs right before a pandemic hit. And, you know, we tried to talk to the prosecutors and tried to explain that we need their assistance. And, you know, really what we got back was some statistics and, you know, that were, you know, some half measures. And
well, hold on.
Just don't get it.
They told you to get used to it.
Yeah, they did. They did. That's actually what really fired me up when, you know, you're familiar with the PowerPoint. They told our detectives, and you've seen the PowerPoint, they told us to get used to it. That's outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. A change needs to occur. I can't tell you how many people have reached out to me encouraging me to run because of this.
And what I don't think people understand, and you certainly understand as someone who actually served within the office as a former King County senior deputy prosecutor, you know, there are many instances in which very serious crimes get in front of Satterberg or one of his prosecutors, and they just allow it to be pled down. Deals get offered where they're not felonies, where in some cases, you know, it gets tossed completely, and people who do some really bad things don't end up going to jail. It's my understanding you are not against restorative justice. You are simply saying that you want the right people to go into restorative justice programs, and folks who are committing serious crimes, there has to be some consequence.
Yeah, you've really got to approach it with a real balanced approach. And, you know, I think diversions and those kinds of things have an absolute critical role, making sure that you get course corrections. But once somebody pulls a trigger in a gun, or if they bring a gun to school, or if you're unlawfully in someone's house in a Resburg, you know, you've really crossed the demarcation line. And the key issue here is accountability. And that's really what's missing from the RCP program right now. And really, frankly, I've been hearing from a lot of people that the wheels have really come off the criminal division, in regard to how they're handling things. It's very concerning about what's happening right now in that office.
Well, what's the first thing you would do in office? Let's say you were elected day one. How would you set things straight?
Well, I think the first and foremost, you know, I would gather all the prosecutors together and talk about the new way we're going to go about it. You know, what's interesting about the current, you know, regime and the current way it's run is they want to sit at both tables. They want to sit at the prosecution and the defense. It's like, pick a table.
Yeah.
And you need somebody that's going to speak for victims and hold people accountable. So I think we're probably the first thing after we got together and talked about, you know, sort of the sea change that would occur is to take a look at what they call the FADS, which is the filing and disposition standards. And, you know, there's been a real mission creep at the office right now in regard to, you know, increasing those standards and pushing them back down to the cities. Now that's a cost distribution, but it's also a justice redistribution. You've got to make sure that when someone commits a felony, they're prosecuted and held accountable for the felony.
I only have two quick questions for you. Only got about a minute left. First one is, do you get the sense that this prosecutor and this prosecutor's office views the criminals as the actual victims?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think that's the issue, that they've really lost sight of the fact that there are victims, you know, to these serious crimes. And I think this emphasis has been on almost exclusively on you know, getting people course corrected. And it is critical. You don't want people to come back, but you also need accountability. And that's the central component of what my office would look like.
And then finally, do you look at Seattle's race for city attorney? You had Ann Davison, who mm-hmm. is a moderate Republican. You're not a Republican, but she was a moderate Republican going up against someone mm-hmm. pretty far to the left, not quite but further to the left of Dan Satterberg, but there are clear similarities. Yeah. Do you see that as, you know, writing on the wall that you are a candidate, or at least your approach can actually win?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It's a great roadmap, and I think really what it highlights is that people, regardless of what political stripe you are, or you know where you find yourself on the political spectrum, we all have an interest in a safe community, in a just community, and making sure that there's accountability, and that if you're the victim of a crime, that it's taken seriously and followed up, and that the system is in place to protect our community and individuals.
There you go. Jim Farrell is the mayor of Federal Way. He has not yet formally announced that he is running for King County Prosecutor, but he's running for King County Prosecutor. We appreciate you coming on the show. We look forward to continuing these conversations over the next several months.
Thank you, Jason. On the day I actually formally announce, I'll come find you.
There you go. You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show.
The Monologue.
We've been covering this incident in Seattle. It actually happened on the day that CHOP was formed, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. And a lot of politicians and activists are upset that on that day, the SPD had the audacity to set up a trick, a ruse, to scare off the Antifa thugs who were armed and the BLM radicals, some of whom were armed, as they ran police out of a 6-block radius of Seattle to set up an autonomous zone that led to the murder of 2 teenagers who happened to be black BLM supporters, that led to the attempted rape of a deaf woman, that led to the attempted arson of a business within the zone, that led to a whole bunch of assaults and vandalism. But other than that, it was totally peaceful. Summer of love. And because cops aren't stupid, they realize that these kinds of results could happen if you give up a part of a neighborhood to radicals. They tried to scare off the Antifa activists from setting up their autonomous zone. And by doing so, they pretended that there were a small group of Proud Boys who were looking for them, thinking that that might cause them to run away. This is actually parts of the audio from that morning.
So we're going to be the ones taking my group down around City Hall to monitor the group of the Proud Boys gathering. Right now it's small, but we don't need any other units at this time. What alpha was that for our group? Do you think those are other Proud Boys just coming down here? Seems like they're kind of starting to muster up, maybe thinking about marching around. Hearing from the Proud Boys group, they're not very happy with their response in the audience down here. They may be looking for somewhere else for confrontation. Break.
Now, they said that because they knew that Antifa folks monitor their open feed, their communications feed. Now, because they did that, and it was a lie, to be clear, they're getting called out. People are calling them out again more than they were calling out the Antifa thugs. In fact, some of the folks who are calling out the police don't even claim that Antifa was involved. But we got a kind of a weird comment from Adrian Diaz, who wasn't the chief at the time, which he knows because he doesn't want to get blamed for this, but he said this.
What we saw a year and a half ago, while I wasn't the chief at the time, was very traumatizing to the community.
Huh.
It had
just real quick, that was traumatizing to the community? No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. I'm not going to use that language. It wasn't traumatizing to the community. Sorry, no, it wasn't. I know you might want to get in with Bruce Harrell, who's the current mayor, who's basically using that same line, but I'm not going to lie about that. It wasn't traumatizing to anybody. What was traumatizing, arguably, was the victims who were murdered. You know, I'm not going to commit fully, but something tells me it was probably traumatic to them as they were getting shot and then ultimately died. Maybe it was traumatizing to the deaf woman who had to fend off a rape over at the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. But this was not traumatizing to anyone. It was cops trying to do their jobs and stop what ultimately became a deadly autonomous zone from getting set up.
The interview.
An interesting report out from Tristan Justice over at The Federalist discussing the fact that Congresswoman Liz Cheney, Republican, is apparently using the January 6th commission to go after some political opponents of hers, ones who just happen to be in an anti-Liz Cheney pack. Tristan joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So take us through exactly what is happening between Liz Cheney and some of these political opponents.
So the House Select Committee on January 6th has already been escalating its subpoenas to private individuals with really no involvement or relation to the Capitol riot whatsoever. They've been targeting mainly people affiliated with the protest at the White House Ellipse that preceded the riot or actually took place while the riot was actually happening. But now the committee has actually moved to subpoenaing people who have no relation even to the White House protest that day. One of those people is Andrew Surabayan. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. But Andrew Surabayan, he was subpoenaed by the committee to hand over documents and testify within the next month. But at the same time that January 6th events were happening, he was actually operating a super PAC in favor of Georgia's Senate candidates. And so the subpoena has nothing to do with any of the events that happened on January 6th, and instead is going after someone who's now operating a super PAC who's working to unseat Liz Cheney at home. So in other words, Liz Cheney is now wielding her power on the January 6th committee to persecute those who are trying to unseat her from Congress.
Yeah, what I find curious about this, I imagine that what she will say in defense is, well, he's a close friend of Don Jr., and obviously that means he might know something about what happened. And that, of course, is a disingenuous kind of connection to anything that happened on January 6th. But normally when you have this kind of abuse of power happening on a committee that's supposedly bipartisan, well, one side would call it out. But in this case, it's not really bipartisan, is it?
Well, it's definitely not a bipartisan committee, considering every member of the committee is Democratic appointed. Remember, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi barred Republican appointments from the committee, Jim Banks and Jim Jordan, last summer. And so House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy pulled the rest of the Republican appointments. And so there is not a single Republican appointed member serving on the committee, which actually violates House statutes and really calls into question the committee's authority to issue subpoenas whatsoever.
Yeah. Now, Andrew Surabayan, or again, I also don't know how you say his name. what is he saying? I know his lawyer put out a statement.
Well, the lawyer put out a statement just highlighting the fact that Surabayan had nothing to do with organizing the White House protest. At the time the protest was being organized, he was operating a super PAC for Georgia Senate candidates. And instead, they're merely going after Surabayan because he's operating the Wyoming Values PAC, which is a political action committee that's working on behalf of Harriet Hageman. She's a Wyoming attorney who's running in a competitive primary challenge against Liz Cheney. As Cheney chases a fourth term, not a single poll has come out since Cheney has escalated her feud with the president and therefore the Republican base, has landed Cheney with more than 25% support among likely primary voters. Let's remember, in 2016, Cheney had 40% of the vote share that got her first term in 2016. And so Cheney's facing a competitive primary challenge, and it's pretty unlikely that she wins the fourth term this fall. And so it makes perfect sense for the congresswoman to be abusing her power and legislative authority, or lack thereof, to go after political opponents at home.
Yeah, I mean, and the good news from her perspective is she, I'm sure, will land a job at CNN or MSNBC because she has been trying out for those.
Or maybe on The View.
Yeah, or maybe on The View. She's been trying out for at least the MSNBC and CNN gigs for about a year now. Where do things stand with, at the end of all of this, the January 6th commission? Because, you know, you look at some of the polling, Americans just don't seem to care all that much about this process. I imagine that would change if there was some sort of bombshell piece of evidence. But, you know, most people don't hold the January 6th date in the same sort of solemn headspace as the Democrats pretend.
Right. Well, January 6th has really become the Democrats' new national holiday. They've explicitly elevated January 6th on the same pedestal, at least in their minds, as 9/11 and Pearl Harbor, when, you know, it's incredibly offensive to veterans and the families and victims of prior attacks. And so the January 6th committee, to this point, it's nothing but politicized partisan probe that's being wielded by Democrats to go after political dissidents and punish their political opponents. The mere fact that just looking at the January January 6th committee subpoenas alone reveals it has nothing to do with probing the actual violence that happened in the Capitol and everything to do with going after political opponents. Nearly every subpoena to this point has gone after those who organized the protest at the White House. If they were actually interested in investigating the violence at the Capitol, they would be subpoenaing Nancy Pelosi, who, as Speaker of the House, is responsible for Capitol security and denied, reportedly, credibly denied requests to the National Guard six times leading up to the riot. And so the committee has nothing to do with the violence and everything to do with going after political dissidents.
Yeah, and really, this is about going after Trump. At the end of the day, they're going to come up with their finding and say, this shows you that we can't allow him to run for president again, blah, blah, blah. I know that Tristan Justice will continue to cover this over at The Federalist, where he is the Western correspondent. You can check out his piece here and all his future pieces over at TheFederalist.com, where I also am a contributor. Tristan, thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz has followed that in detail. He's a radio host in Seattle. He broke this story. He joins us now.
Never shy of his opinion, Jason. Definitely letting you know how he feels about that.
Wow. You laid that down.
Long Form. Presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
The 42nd Legislative District has a new state senator. Someone who considered himself to be the underdog as the county council was choosing the replacement for the late Senator Doug Erickson, who tragically lost his life after dealing with COVID. Simon Sefcik is only 22 years old. He's a community activist. He's a recent graduate of Patrick Henry College and probably didn't expect that he would start out the new year as the new state senator. And yet, here he is, representing the 42nd District. Joining me on the line is Simon Sefcik, new state senator. Senator, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Let's lean right into the age thing, because I think that the part of the reason probably you thought you might have been perceived as the underdog was because of your age, that a lot of people automatically assume, oh, he's too young, he's not going to be able to get anything done. And yet you find yourself now in a position to represent a whole lot of people.
Well, that's right, Jason. And yes, you're right. You know, I understand that I am younger, perhaps, than most people involved in politics. But I sincerely believe that one of the reasons, perhaps, that we get so little out of my current generation is because we expect so little. And I believe if we look at the history of our country, it's filled with young people that had the audacity to try to work hard to achieve something better for their own lives and for the lives of their children and grandchildren. And so I'm excited, and I don't view my age as a liability. I view it as an asset, because I think it's important to include young people in the discussion, because we're going to be the ones that are the largest tax base. We're going to be the ones that have to make the decisions about tomorrow's future.
Let's talk about one issue that is definitely going to hit a lot of young folks in ways it won't hit some others, the Long-Term Care Trust Act. I know there's conversations about fixing it. I don't know if it's even fixable, but the problem is, as a current
want nothing more in life than to be able to serve their brothers and sisters that have had their jobs terminated and their unemployment benefits canceled purely because of their decision regarding a medical choice. And when I look them in the eyes, when I hear their voices, there's a lot of pain and there's a lot of frustration right now. Why one individual has the power to not only cancel their jobs, but in many ways to cancel their hope. Their hope for their future and their ability to help one another and quite simply to just get by here in Washington. It's one of those things that when it's compounded with the housing affordability issues going on, continual rising inflation, as you probably saw the numbers today, that to have all of that going on and then to slap these good, hardworking people with this vaccine mandate is absolutely heartbreaking to see. And so I want to do everything we can to support those people and to help them get the service and the care that they need.
What's just remarkable to me is, and we broke the story last night, you know, you have multi-care hospitals around the state, and they're not the only ones doing this, but they are in a staffing crisis like so many others are, to the point where they have allowed COVID-positive symptomatic staff members to return to work and see patients. So I fail to see the difference between that happening and someone who's unvaccinated, has already had COVID, or is unvaccinated and COVID negative. I don't understand why the unvaccinated person is more dangerous than the vaccinated person who currently has COVID, currently has symptoms, and is seeing patients.
I completely agree, and I couldn't try to explain it even if I was even if I tried. But you know what I want people to remember about that too is that this is important about our future, because once we give elected officials power, or at least once they claim to take that power, it is very rare for them to ever give that power back to the people. And that's the critical thing to remember about what we're witnessing today and in the past months and in the upcoming months. The types of power that is given to the government is never returned to the people, and it should be. And so the basic idea of checks and balances between different branches of governments, when that erodes, you know, we talk all the time about what takes away, what erodes democracy or democratic republic. It's that. It's your fundamental trust in your institutions and your accountability to one another. And that's why, regardless of your political preferences, whether you're Republican or Democrat, I think we're on the same page in terms of scaling back some of the dangerous emergency powers that have been granted.
I certainly hope so.
To Governor Inslee.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I always look at some of the polling nationally, and that seems to be the direction that people are going in. I think that's why they look at President Biden and say, wow, we're only giving you like 33% approval on COVID response. But then I look at some of the polling here in Washington, and because it's such a blue state, you know, we kind of get the opposite of that they seem to enjoy the fact that Jay Inslee holds this kind of power over people. And by the way, the power he's holding to get people vaccinated, the people who like that are the ones who are already vaccinated. So this doesn't really impact them in nearly the same way as it does someone else. And that's coming from someone who's both pro-vaccine and vaccinated. I'm just like you. I don't support mandates coming from the government or frankly from businesses, even though they have the right to do that. Real quickly, before we let you go, what are you looking forward to the most just this week as you're sort of savoring the opening days of what hopefully will be a long career?
Well, Jason, to be honest with you, I don't know that I've had a chance to kind of stop, slow down, and smell the roses. We've been so busy working away already for the people of the 42nd District. But you know, as I sit where I've been sitting, and as I've walked already through the Capitol, I am just humbled and honored to be here and to have this opportunity. You know, I know that Senator Erickson's loss was heartbreaking to so many, and I know I have a lot to learn, but I want everyone to know that I'm excited to learn, and I want to learn especially from people with which I disagree, because I do think it's possible, despite the cynicism of our current age, I do believe that it's possible for us to disagree without being disagreeable, to come together and to work together to find common solutions. And that's what yeah. gets me going each day, and that's what I'm excited about to deliver and bring to the people of the 42nd District.
Well said. We're looking forward to seeing what you can do once you actually get a chance to show us. So Simon Sefcik is the new state senator for the 42nd District out in Whatcom County. We look forward to having more conversations with you as the session gets underway. Thank you so much for stopping by, as always. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason. You take care.
Absolutely. Now this.
The Jason Rance Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rance. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rance is in focus now.
Jason Rance, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
Okay, so Ted Cruz, yet again, basically made a fool out of a reporter. Don't actually know who the reporter is. This was happening at one of the press availabilities in the Senate. And, you know, the camera was facing Ted Cruz and the other senators who were at a microphone, and the unnamed and unseen reporters were asking them some questions. And Ted Cruz got pretty ticked off when a reporter asked him about why he wasn't wearing a mask at the podium. And he makes a really important and valid point.
On the question of hypocrisy, you just asked, you people at the podium are speaking without masks. Just once, I'd like to see a reporter say to Joe Biden, when he stands at the damn podium in the White House without a mask, Mr. President, why aren't you wearing a mask? Just once, I'd like to see you say to Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, when she stands at the podium with no mask, Ms. Psaki, why don't you have a mask? The questions are only directed at one side, and I got to say, the American people see the hypocrisy.
They very clearly see the hypocrisy. They very clearly see how the Democrats and the media enablers don't really seem to have any clue what it is they're doing. They like to talk. They like to lecture. They like to virtue signal. They love the self-preening. They love talking about how they're all heroes. They love the shaming of anyone who doesn't do exactly what they want them to do, but they don't love to actually lead these Democrats or the enablers of these Democrats. And Ted Cruz's point is valid. Why doesn't anyone ask the same question? They're supposed to stand there at the podium with a mask on answering. Okay, if the reporter there holds that position or reporters hold that position, okay, fine. I think it's a ridiculous one. Why don't they have the same exact question of Jen Psaki in a much smaller room that's not as well ventilated as where Ted Cruz was? When she steps to the podium, she's got her mask off. Why is that acceptable if it's not acceptable for Ted Cruz? What about the questions for President Biden? I mean, this is a guy who was wearing a mask outdoors on an open beach where no one was around him except for his wife. And on the topic of the mask, why aren't we asking the question as to why is the CDC so slow to react? Why is the media so slow to react to news that we knew of last year and earlier that cloth masks aren't actually effective? Cloth masks do nothing, virtually nothing, to stop the spread of COVID. And yet we are still in a position where we have to have those masks on, whether we're on a plane, whether we're on a bus. But cloth masks don't work. Here is yet another official in Dr. Michael Osterholm on MSNBC.
Well, I guess to put this into perspective, I'd say, in fact, no. The science was there. We published work back as early as April of 2020 saying that, in fact, that this virus is transmitted by an aerosol, that kind of perfume-like floating in the room, and that we needed to have that very high level of respiratory protection. The world was slow to come to that. And today the CDC has still been slow to come to that point.
This is not a quack pot. This is the Regents Professor and Director for the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He and so many others knew this early on. Now, do I think it is concerning that, like, within the first couple months, 3 months of a virus that we had never heard of before that was brand new in a global pandemic was causing some confusion as to what would work? No, I'm not concerned with that. I don't think it's problematic that within a few months, they were maybe slow to move because they needed to make sure. And I get that. Because if they were wrong, the consequences are severe. But they still haven't said anything. They still haven't said anything. He knew this in April 2020. And again, do I expect them to make a change in April of 2020 when we just really learned of the virus in late January? No, I don't. But it's January 2022 and the CDC still hasn't moved. And it's rather telling that they haven't moved because they know that it doesn't work at the same time that Omicron is spreading like wildfire. Now, maybe this is their way of getting us to actually hit a point of herd immunity. Knowing that you're going to get it, thinking that you're safe because you're wearing a mask, a cloth mask. The data suggests, the research suggests, that the surgical masks work better. And really, that's a low bar, to be fair, because cloth masks just don't do anything. And that's according to the experts, not the quackpots, not the ones who don't believe COVID even exists, as few of those people as there are. This is according to the experts.
The Last Rant.
And with that, speaking of experts, I went to my doctor's office today. I go to a particular hospital, clinic, or whatever we want to call it, in Seattle to get just regular treatment for my asthma. This was just a checkup. I haven't seen him in 6 months. We go every 6 months, basically. And I, yet again, had the experience of walking in to see all the political nonsense up on walls. Black Lives Matter posters. Of course, if they were to put up a pro-life poster, they would be told to take it down. But in this case, you got Black Lives Matter posters. That's cool.
And of course, you're supposed to, you know, respect the political positions and social positions of the workforce. They get to have lives outside of the office, and they get to believe what they want to believe. Certainly, I agree with that. But do I really need to see that at the office? Or is it possible, just possible, even in Seattle, that for 10 minutes, I can go about my life, do routine things like visit a doctor without getting hit over the head with someone's political positions? I don't care to know any of the political positions of any of the doctors or nurses or any staff members at any hospital, period. I want to know, can they do their job effectively? I just want to be able to go into an office, not have to wait in a doctor's office for 15 minutes after my appointment before I'm seen, and just get out. That's all I want. I want good service. I want to be treated fine. But instead, we're treated to the political positions of everybody who feels empowered to share because they're allowed to. Unless, of course, they have a conservative position. Then, oh my gosh, you're not seeing any of that stuff at the Polyclinic or Virginia Mason or Sweden. You're not going to see any of that there. It's absolutely absurd. It's maddening. And that's the last rant.